from the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin. Welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today is Dr. Nathan Wellum. He's an associate professor in the Division of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, and he's a practicing speech-language pathologist. Dr. Wellum sees patients through the UW Health Voice and Swallow Clinics for a wide range of voice disorders. He also coaches singers, actors, and other voice professionals in voice health. But late last year, Dr. Wellum really made a splash in the national and international media when he and his research team grew functional vocal tissue in the lab. Dr. Wellum, welcome to The Surgery Set.
Thank you.
So I first learned about you, even though we work in the same building, from, I don't remember if it was the New York Times or the BBC or somewhere there was a picture of artificial vocal cords saying that Dr. Nathan Wellum at the University of Wisconsin had made these things. How did you get there?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
I think the fairest thing to say in beginning is that it's not that I got there or I myself, you know, achieved anything. This is really the fruit of a team effort in basic science and translational science. And we work, I direct a lab and we work on problems that mostly involve voice and vocal fold biology, such as this topic. But we also work with a whole group of, you know, partners across the campus on different aspects of this. So we got there by working as a team is the simple big answer, I guess.
Right. What are some of the departments that have sort of played a role in this pretty groundbreaking event?
Well, you know,
what are the widgets in the big machine?
In this particular case, we work with some partners in chemistry is one area because we're really trying to understand, first of all, what is special or unique about the tissue in our voice box, the vocal folds that allows them to make voice, really. And we use some techniques to kind of unravel what makes vocal folds special, I guess, in terms of all the proteins that make them up, to try and understand their function. And then on the flip side of that, use that to try and rebuild the structure. We also worked with some of our partners in our department here in the Division of Transplantation, trying to understand some of the immunology of taking a structure like this and putting it in the body and seeing what happens. And then some other people who work in areas of material science or understanding the properties of tissues and how stretchy or stiff or whatever they are. So all these different kinds of people might normally never interact, but we pulled them together for this particular project, trying to engineer, create a replacement, you know, vocal cord tissue.
Yeah. And you actually, in your lab, created a set of living or cellular vocal cords?
Kind of. I mean, essentially, what we began this project actually not even thinking of creating a therapy or creating something that could be used to replace a vocal fold. We were just trying to understand the biology itself, actually, just understand the tissue and understand vocal fold primary cells themselves. Part of the reason is in our area of study, we don't know too much because we can't always take these tissues from patients. We can't take a biopsy or something like that because it causes some damage to the tissue and affects someone's voice.
Right.
So it's rare that we get the opportunity to really study the biology. And we were trying to do that essentially. And it was only when we started harvesting and working with these cells and doing different things with them that we realized, gosh, these cells that are inside our vocal folds and are in a very special environment or set of circumstances where they're vibrating hundreds of times a second throughout years and years as we voice, these cells seem to be able to be used to recreate the tissue in the lab that's somewhat similar to the tissue we have in the body. So we kind of...
So they're sort of regenerative just by necessity, and you can harness that.
Seems to be. I mean, I don't think we have a very sophisticated understanding of any of this really, but we were able to use those cells to recapitulate the structure and function of the vocal fold. It's kind of a voice and vocal fold stuff is just really interesting to me because we have these tissues, they sit in the throat or sit in the neck, and unlike the rest of the tissues in the body that have many different functions, these tissues vibrate hundreds of times a second there's this collision that is happening again and again and again, and some kind of, you know, micro injury and repair that's ongoing. And then also they turn airflow into sound and
right.
create this thing that is useful for communication in a conversation like this, but is also useful as an art form, a form of expression for actors or singers or anyone really. So it's just an interesting kind of area.
And it's such a, on the one hand, it's such a sort of seemingly simple principle, right? You control airflow through an aperture and the speed and the size of the aperture or whatever, like changes tone. But the degree of control that we can master of those tiny little pieces of tissue is really extraordinary.
Yeah, you're right. I agree.
Yeah. And I understand that your vocal folds actually do make sound, like you're able to create sound through the folds that you created, or?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So just like the vocal folds in my voice box or your voice box, they can generate sound. And we tested that, or we proved that point in the research that we did. We could take the tissue, graft them into a voice box, and mount them on a fake windpipe and deliver ear and make them vibrate and create sound and compare them with the real thing.
Wow.
So that was some of the testing that we did to really show just what they could do.
Yeah. What's the future of this? I mean, I assume that there are a long series of hurdles between here and vocal cord transplants.
Oh, I think so. You know, what we really achieved was a proof of principle kind of thing in the lab. And so to take something like this and translate it all the way to the patient requires a lot of satisfying of different regulatory agencies and looking at safety as well as efficacy through a whole series of trials, as I'm sure you're aware. So it's, you know, complicated and expensive to do. But we're trying to learn more about the potential of this approach as a therapy and studying it in more sophisticated ways inside the body, just not on the bench and things like this, to see if it does have potential going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I assume you knew when you published a paper describing that you had created vocal folds that it would get some sort of press interest. Did you expect that it would be the international sensation that it was?
Probably not at all. I think we finished this piece of work and we were happy with it and proud of it and, you know, thought it would be appreciated in our field, which is a pretty tiny field. There aren't that many people who are so nuts about vocal fold stuff like us. So I thought it would be well received. But no, I had no expectation or thought that it would be picked up by the mainstream media or anything like that. Or did I realize that once that had happened, I would be contacted by wave after wave of patients. You know, stories to tell about their own issues with voice or swallow problems or volunteering for future trials if we get to that stage, that kind of thing.
How extraordinary.
So, there was a lot of things I didn't think about.
Yeah.
That could happen and did happen.
And have you felt that all of that attention, I mean, it must be stressful in a way. And obviously the press tendency must be towards reduction of, oh, now we have artificial vocal cords. Everyone with a vocal cord problem, just head to Madison. And, you know, how does the way that it was portrayed in the press compare to sort of the reality?
You know, I think both on the part of journalists, and I'm speaking to it, someone with a journalistic background, right? There's some oversimplification or simplification of the process, but that's not necessarily a problem. I think that's part of the role there in disseminating this to a non-scientific audience. There has to be some simplification or translation, I guess, in some sense.
Yeah.
But it's certainly true that when I started to hear from patients who had read the stuff or heard it on the radio or seen it on TV, their understanding of what they were reading and putting themselves in, or their own medical problem into the mix, there was really a lot of jumps that were made, I guess.
Yeah.
Or a lot of leaps in ways that I wouldn't, you know, to me seem completely far removed. But, you know, some of the things were just amazing, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it must be so difficult. I sort of imagine, you know, as scientists and physicians and clinical practitioners think about the way that our patients interpret what they hear and the expectations that they have when they engage the medical system. I think that one of the things that we have to sort of continually battle is this idea that, you know, maybe if it isn't, you know, Star Trek medicine, it's at least, you know, people are coming in with an expectation of, you know, Grey's Anatomy medicine, which in and of itself has a whole range of expectations that are maybe not congruent with the reality of honest to goodness patient care. And you sort of had a Star Trek moment. So I can only imagine what hope that would have presented to people who, you know, are in bad situations, but who, you know, maybe we're not quite ready to fix their problems yet, but it's what a hope it must be for them to know that this sort of thing is not pure science fiction. I mean, we really are doing some amazing things.
It's amazing what some of the developments in preclinical medicine are bringing and promising in general.
Yeah.
That's certainly the case. You know, here is perhaps the most unbelievable story that I received, or potential patient, whatever contact that I had. So, I had hundreds and hundreds of people contact me, and it was a little overwhelming at the beginning, but I decided to just put them all aside. And then a few minutes every day, I'd respond to a couple, and I tried to give each person the dignity of a response, even if I couldn't, you know, most of these people I couldn't help at all.
Sure.
But maybe I could point them to a provider in their country their state or you know, give a little bit of advice.
Yeah, and that's extraordinary in itself. So
I just felt some responsibility, I guess, to do that. So, you know, I had all the kinds of people sent all these messages or called or whatever. And I can hardly believe this, but I was emailed by one mother who was, this is last year during the refugee crisis, you know, really swelling to this big thing in Europe, and all this stuff was going on. And there was a mother, a Syrian refugee family, who was escaping Syria on the boats and then walking across Europe and all this stuff. And they had heard a story about this work on the BBC World Report on their transistor radio as they're walking across Europe.
Oh my gosh.
And what had happened was they had a child who had seen some awful things as they were leaving.
Mm.
And it's what sounds like developed some elective mutism or a situation where the child, I think a boy, just stopped speaking.
Wow.
And, you know, this is not something it's not my specialty actually in my area of practice, but I've seen it, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I saw one case like this. A little bit of familiarity.
Uh-huh.
So this mom writes this heart-wrenching email in broken English, saying, you know, this happened to us, and my son can't speak, and then we're walking and we hear this thing on a radio, and then they found an internet cafe or something, and they had landed in France finally.
Huh.
And she said, you know, can you help my son? And
wow.
This was such a heavy,
right,
intense kind of message. So I took a few days to kind of mull it over and decide how to respond or what to say to this mother. And in the end, I just wrote back and said, you know, obviously, you know, I can't even imagine the journey that you guys have gone through. And this, you obviously love your child a lot. The thing that we've been working on in our lab doesn't really help with this kind of problem, but
right.
Here's the kind of services you need to try and find if you can,
yeah,
in the community that you've landed in. And if you can get some help and find A, B, and C, then, you know, I think you may be on the right track. And that for me was just a really intense experience, and something, you know, if we go all the way back to the start and working in the lab and doing this other stuff on this very specific project, I never would have thought I would end up having a conversation with this refugee about this issue with her child.
Yeah. You transcended like an investigator who made a discovery and you became the international face of speech.
I guess. Yeah. I guess.
Right. And what an extraordinary thing. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I rarely have had those kind of conversations, even as a clinician. I mean, plenty of things dealing with patient concerns and troubleshooting problems and things like that. But this was really, you know, emotionally loaded.
How extraordinary. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you are a practicing clinician as well, then, on top of
I'm
stuff.
A speech pathologist. And so here within our division of otolaryngology, we have a practice where we treat people with voice and swallow problems.
So you, within that, do you have a specific discipline, or are you sort of an all-comers speech pathologist?
So speech pathologists in general are trained to treat and diagnose and assess all kinds of things, ranging from childhood speech language development, reading, stuttering, things like that early on in life, all the way through to, at the other end of the spectrum, neurodegenerative things and stroke, swallow problems, speech language there. Mm-hmm. My main interest and specialty is in things relating to the larynx and voice production, obviously. So usually people have something happening here with the voice production mechanism, more so than, say, language processing in the brain or language memory or some of the other things that we deal with more widely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you do laryngeal work for people with established pathologies, but also the coaching work on voice and...
Yeah, it could be. I mean, yeah. Plenty of it. Just it really depends. A lot of people who are voice professionals, I guess you could say, are at risk of occupational kind of problems just because of the kind of jobs they do. So teachers are a classic example of a group of people who are at risk for voice problems just because of how much they have to speak in their jobs. So those kind of individuals often come in with problems. We deal with plenty of things related to head and neck cancer, obviously, and things that affect the larynx, other lesions and things that can grow in the voice box, psychological things that express as a voice problem. Just depends. The variety is really interesting.
That's fantastic. So, you divide your time to the best of your ability between your very busy basic science and your busy clinical practice?
Yeah, I do both. And yeah. So most of my effort is dedicated to the research enterprise.
Yeah.
And I just do one day a week of practice.
Do you feel like that day of practice, that clinical work, must inform your basic science work and the way you ask and answer questions?
Yeah, unquestionably.
Yeah.
It's really important, I think, just to remember why we're doing what we're doing, to stimulate questions and things like that. And then as the work that we're doing in the lab gets closer and closer to translation, then I hope we can bring some things back in and introduce them as well.
So I mean, getting to that point, 10 years from now, where do you want to see the work that you're doing now? Where is it going?
Oh, that's a big question.
Obviously, right?
10 years is a long time. I think within 10 years, I hope that we know a lot more about the potential of this tissue engineering technique for replacing the whole vocal fold mucosa, which is what we were doing. If it really looks like it has the legs to be a viable therapy and we're closer to really trying to translate or get permission to do a trial or something like that. Or, I'm kind of a realist, or we learn what we need to know and realize that, no, there are some issues with this approach and we need to really go down a different path.
Yeah.
It's tempting to look at a piece of work that was a really successful piece of science, but then was viewed very successfully and get a little bit over-enthusiastic. But, the point of the next steps are to learn if it is going to work, not just to keep going forward, regardless of what we learn.
Right. Absolutely. Well, it sounds, obviously, it's incredible work, and it's a privilege to be able to hear about it, even though we don't yet have an international audience with this podcast, but we're thrilled to have you with us here today. And thank you so much for coming in and taking the time to explain this extraordinary story. So
thanks. My pleasure to chat with you. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Surgery Set. Join us next time when our guest will be Dr. Lee Neumeier. She's an expert in surgical education and the chair of the University of Arizona Department of Surgery. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon.